Right. Seattle has picked a new name. Wisconsin, a couple of Wisconsin chapters have picked a new name. Illinois has picked a new name, or Chicago has picked a new name. I lose track. There have been so many that have changed names. And a lot of us, though not all of us, have settled. Oh, Georgia picked a new name. But a lot of us have settled on Bird Alliance as the new name. So we are now the NYC Bird Alliance. And the hope is that, and the idea is not, you know, to erase Audubon, to cancel Audubon. You can't. The man's history is what it is. You know, like I said, you've got to give it an asterisk, but it's there. It's real. But that doesn't mean you got to have that name on your organization, particularly when you're trying to take an organization that for so long has been almost exclusively white, and you're trying to get other people involved. You know, you don't, for example, imagine you were a country club that had a history of excluding Jews. And you're like, oh my goodness, we got to change that. We've got to invite some Jews. Hey, guys, don't you want to join the Joseph Mengele Country Club? How many Jews are you going to get? You're not. That's kind of what we were facing with Audubon. So it's not a matter of erasing him. The history is still there. It comes with an asterisk, but it's there. But looking forward and getting everybody involved. And why is it so important to diversify? Not just because it's the right thing to do, but because we have lost one-third of our birds in North America. I'm not talking about species. I'm talking about raw numbers. The populations are down in my lifetime. I know this because I go out there and I bird and I feel it and I see it, and we all do. We have lost one-third of the birds in North America just in my lifetime since I started birding when I was about 10 years old. And the only way we're going to turn this around, because we can turn it around, we've done it in New York City in some ways, is if we get everybody involved in birding that possibly could be interested, because the country is diversifying. New York City is already a diverse city. If we don't have all hands on deck, we're not going to be able to save the birds.
So, Christian, you exploded onto the national scene a few years ago because of an incident in Central Park. And let's go back to that day. We're talking about Memorial Day 2020. So it's in the height of the pandemic. Everyone is masked. There are no vaccines. It is horrifyingly also the day that George Floyd was killed. But when you were out in Central Park that morning, he was still alive. Mm-hmm. And we want to turn to what happened on that day. Describe to us what time you went out in the morning and what you were doing and then what happened.
Condensed version, I got out at 5:30, which is my usual time to hit the park that time of year. I'm looking for birds. It was a relatively slow day. There was a particular bird called a morning warbler, which is typically one of the last warblers to come through in the migration. So this is very late in the migration, and I'm looking for a morning warbler. Morning warblers are skulkers. They stay close to the ground for the most part, hidden in the shrubs. So I'm heading towards this patch of shrubs to look for a morning warbler.
How did you know it was there?
Oh, I didn't know it was there. I'm hoping to find it. So I'm keeping my ears open for cheery, 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 chory. Cheery, 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 chory. That's the song of the morning warbler. And if I hear that, and I know there's one hiding in those shrubs, and I got to wait him out and look for him. So I'm heading for a patch of habitat of low-lying growth where I'm likely to find one. And then I hear, Henry! At the top of the lungs, the way nobody would talk to a human being. So I know it's a dog off the leash. And then I see it tearing exactly through the low-growing growth where I was hoping to find a morning warbler. I'm like, well, if there was one there before, there's not one there now. So this is an ongoing problem in Central Park, particularly in the Ramble, where dogs have to be on the leash at all times. There are signs posted everywhere telling everybody that. So this has been an ongoing war between certain dog walkers. I don't want to tar all dog walkers with a bad brush, because there are some who actually follow the rules. But this has been an ongoing war for many, many, many years between dog walkers and birders. And so, you know, we got into it. I'm like, you know, look, Your dog's supposed to be on the leash, the sign's right there. Look, all you have to do is take the dog across the road there to that other part of the park. You're outside the ramble. You can have your dog off the leash until 9 a.m. and we're all good. She was having none of it. So at that point, we started to get into it and, you know, verbally and
you're how many feet away from her?
Well, she, much further than you are from me. So
you're both wearing masks.
Yeah, I've got like a bandana over my face at that point because we didn't really have mask protocols yet, and she's got a mask on, and then so she eventually ends up picking up the dog by the collar,
not leashing it, but picking it up,
right
by the collar,
right, because let's not relive the whole thing, but the bottom line is I start recording her with my iPhone because that's one of the strategies we have when people are breaking the rules is to document it. It puts pressure on them because most people don't like to be recorded breaking the rules, and it's documentation for us to show the Parks Department.
Please take your phone off.
Please don't come close to me.
Please
call the cops. Please call the cops.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
Please tell them whatever you like.
I'm sorry, I'm in a ramble, and there's a man, African-American, he has a bicycle helmet. He's recording me and threatening me and my dog. There is an African-American man, I am in Central Park. He's recording me and threatening myself and my dog. And my dog. I'm being threatened by a man in the ramble. Please send the cops immediately. I'm in Central Park in the ramble. I don't know.
And at that point, you know, I had a decision to make because it was clearly an attempt to, you know, racially intimidate me to get what she wanted, which was for her to be able to have her dog running around as she saw fit. And, you know, neither of us was really willing to budge. We were both incredibly stubborn in that moment. And I just thought, you know, I'm not going to be complicit in my own dehumanization. I am not going to acquiesce here. I'm just going to keep doing what I would do whether I was black, brown, green, or purple, which is record her until that dog is on the leash. And so, and whatever happens is going to have to be on her. So she, you know, called the police and did all that. And then it's funny because you see the video, and the second she puts that dog on the leash, I am done with her. I'm like, thank you, click, and I go on, and I go back to burning.
But say again what she continued to repeat on the phone, what you understood when she called 911.
Right, she said, well, she told me first, I'm going to call the police and tell them that an African-American man is threatening my life. And of course, you know, I'm like, whoa, you know, I'm not an idiot. I've grown up as a black man in America my whole life. I know this is a world of hurt potentially coming my way, but you know, I'm not gonna acquiesce to this and let this intimidate me.
So talk about what happened with that video then.
You know, the I put it on Facebook because I have a tendency to put what happened that's notable to me on Facebook after a day of birding. Usually it's a bird. This was not a bird, but I put it on Facebook. Immediately, one or two friends called me up and said, can you make this public so I can share it? And I'm like, all right, fine. And then my sister called me, and she was seething, understandably. And she said, can I put it on Twitter? And I'm like, okay, yeah, sure, put it on Twitter. And then it just kind of exploded. And became a thing, and you know, became even more of a thing because it ended up being on the same day that George Floyd was murdered. So, you know, it was a window, I think, for a lot of people into what we African Americans know because we live it every day. But I think for a lot of people who aren't African American, they were able to see in those two videos, you know, the use of racial bias and how it informs policing, or people try to use it in policing sometimes, and then the actual police response, you know, against African Americans that gets us killed. So it opened some eyes, I think, maybe, that hadn't been open before for a while.
Did the police come?
They did eventually come, or as I understand it, but by then we were both long gone. You know, I considered at the moment staying around to clear things up with the police, and then I thought, no, she doesn't get to do that. I'm here to bird, and I'm going back to birding. And, you know, and if I run into the police, tell them what happened. But meanwhile, I'm looking for birds. And I did that, and no police came, and then I left the park and went home.
Did you find the warbler?
I did not find the Morning Warbler that morning.
So Cyrus Vance was the Manhattan DA. Talk about what they wanted to happen and your response overall and what happened to Amy Cooper.
So the bottom line is Cyrus Vance wanted to, you know, it was a very public case. So the Manhattan DA wanted to prosecute her for filing a false report, which is fine. You know, that's his prerogative. He wanted my participation in that, and that's where I had to make a decision as to whether or not I was going to pursue it. And I chose not to. And that was a hard decision. And I know a lot of people, especially black people, you know, were not happy with that decision. But I had to kind of trust my conscience. And my conscience said, you know, her life had imploded. She lost her job. She was a pariah. Nationwide, you know, if none of that is going to send a message to people, this is not the thing to do, then I'm not sure anything will. It felt like piling on my part, and I was, and what? You have the ability to pursue these charges without me. Please, you know, go ahead and do so if you feel the need. Don't feel like I need to participate in this. So that was what I decided. And it was a hard decision because I get it. You know, this was possibly precedent setting that, you know, when there are so many cases where black people have been falsely accused and suffered for it, to actually get someone for doing that. So I understand why it was important, particularly to a lot of black people. But ultimately, my conscience said, you know, this is not the way to go. And there's something more important, which is that keep your eyes on the prize. Mm-hmm. You know, we can spend our time throwing Amy Cooper behind bars and pat ourselves on the back that, oh, yeah, we got that one. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court is rolling back affirmative action. And, you know, and Florida is changing education on black people so that it's, you know, a happy, happy, sunny, sunny time, you know, for 300 years. Which of these things are more important? Where should we put our focus? What should we really be changing? You know, meanwhile, the people in Washington, D.C., the largely black and brown population in Washington, D.C., still don't have representation. Even though there's more people there than in all white Wyoming and all white Vermont. And they each get two senators. Washington, D.C. gets nothing. Which of these things should we put our focus and our energy on is going to really make a change? So, you know, Amy Cooper, her life is hers. Let her live it as she sees fit. You know, whatever she makes of it from here on in, you know, judge her by that, and it's up to her. You know, but my energy was focused on eyes on the prize, you know, making real progress for us.
We'll be back with Christian Cooper in 20 seconds.
Paul and Silas bound in jail, had no money for to go their bail. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize.
Eyes on the Prize, performed by Sweet Honey and The Rock and James Horner. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're continuing our conversation with Christian Cooper, author of Better Living Through Birding, Notes from a Black Man in the Natural World. He talked about how he got into birding.
My father was a science teacher for his whole life, and for a good stretch of that, a biology teacher. So nature was always very important to him. And he took us camping a lot as kids. So nature was always very important in our household. For me, for whatever reason, it took the particular form of birds. I built a bird feeder and put it up in the backyard, and I saw this bird coming to it, and it was all black with a patch of red on the wings, and I was like, I've discovered this new species of crow, and I was like excited with my, you know, tour de force of youthful scientific discovery, and then found out it was a red-winged blackbird. But it's still one of my favorite birds to this day, and that's what you would call my spark bird, which is in the lingo of bird watchers, that's the bird that gets you started birding. And after that, it was just sort of like going down the rabbit hole. So that's what started it at about 9 or 10. And I just kept at it. And then my dad took me to the birdwalks of the South Shore Audubon Society, which at the time were led by this guy named Elliot Kuttner, who was just like ebullience personified. And he took one look at me and my interest in birds, and he was like, this one's mine. And from then on, you know, it was great. He nurtured that and that interest.
And how did it come to serve as a kind of, because you mentioned that several times in the book, as a kind of refuge from the different forms of marginalization or exclusion that you felt, both as a black man and also as someone who's queer.
Yeah, and also it was a part of the marginalization, ironically, because, you know, being a birder in the 70s in junior high and high is not going to make you the most popular kid on the planet. No, but what it is, and this is true for everybody, I would say, is that birding forces you outside of yourself. Mm. Whatever your woes are. For me, it was, you know, being in the closet, because I know I was gay from like the age of five. For me, it was being in the closet. You know, if you're worried about your rent, if you're worried about, you know, oh my God, my life is a misery, I have this illness or whatever. And then you get outside and you're looking for birds. And so, first of all, you're in this beautiful, you know, natural setting or semi-natural setting. So that calms you down. Takes you outside yourself. But then if you want to see birds, you've got to focus. You've got to be listening and looking, or else you're not going to see any birds. And when you do that, you're engaging with the world around you in such a way that whatever those woes are, for at least a little while, they fall away. And it's very meditative. It's transporting. It makes you feel connected to the whole planet. It engages your senses, your intellect. It is incredibly healing. And that's one of the reasons why I'm like, black people do this. Because if there's anybody in this society that needs healing, that needs to have our woes fall away for a while, it's us. And then add the fact that, you know, birds are the ultimate symbol of freedom, because there is no part of the planet that is inaccessible to them. They can fly. They are symbols of freedom. So for a people whose history is about being enslaved, for us to be able to relate to this bird, it's liberating. So that's why I think birding was so important for me as a kid, and why I just think everybody, but particularly black people, should be birding in droves.
You become head of the Harvard Ornithological Society, the club.
Yes, I have to put a caveat on that, because, you know, there were like three or four of us, so it's not like some epic accomplishment.
But you also come out to your roommates and your friends there. Mm-hmm. And talk about those moments. Talk about the humanity of that, as we're in the middle of Pride Month right now, mm-hmm. In the middle of June. And we also want to talk about the activism of ACT UP and the LGBTQ community, even beyond specifically LGBTQ issues, but it becomes a paradigm for activism right through to today.
Well, and remember that, you know, that paradigm was picked up from the Vietnam anti-war movement and from the civil rights movement and from the feminist movement. So, you know, it's a strand of activism that goes way back, and you know, the LGBTQ community, we've been able to pick it up and keep it going. And who knows who'll pick it up after us. But, well, the trans community is picking it up. They're part. I consider them part of the, well, they're the T in LGBT. But, you know, they're the ones who are really under attack right now, and they are fighting fiercely and boldly and wonderfully and happily and with joy more often than not. And it's glorious to see. It's often said that the greatest act of activism that someone who's queer can perform is to come out and be out and live out. And so for me, that was really the turning point in college. Freshman year, I had hoped to go to Harvard and finally break out of this suffocating closet that I was in. The only person who knew that I was gay was Deb, and I had only told her like the second semester of senior year in high school. So I'm like, all right, whole new life in Harvard. And I get to Harvard, I'm making these great friends, and I'm back in the closet. And the metaphor I always use is being in the closet felt like being buried alive. Because you know you're there, but nobody else knows. They're like walking over your grave and don't even realize it, and you are banging on that coffin lid, wanting, needing to be let out, and you can't get out, and nobody hears you. That's the experience of being in the closet. So I was done with it by about one semester, my first semester freshman year. I'm like, something has to give, or I'm gonna, you know, not make it. So I went to each of my roommates one by one and told them, you know, look, because we were talking about rooming together the next year, and I said, well, then there's something you need to know, which is that I'm gay. And they all took it well. The last one I told was my friend Mike, who we actually shared a bedroom. And he was like, ha, 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 because we were always, you know, pulling gags on each other. He's like, ha, ha, ha. And I was like, and he said, really? I said, yeah, really. And there was this pause where you could see his brain kind of working through it. And then finally he said, it's cool. And that was it. And from then on, you know, we were just a group of, you know, guys who were bonded together and stayed together for the 4 years of college.
Which takes us to The Extraordinary Birder. Talking about television for a minute, you have now starred in this National Geographic series. And congratulations for getting this Daytime Emmy in the Outstanding Daytime Personality category. So despite what you say, you are an extraordinary birder.
Well, you haven't seen my nighttime personality. It's horrifying.
Well, I want to turn to the introduction that plays at the beginning of each episode of Extraordinary Birder.
Look at all those ravens. I'm Christian Cooper, and I am a birder.
Oh, that was cool.
My dad was a biology teacher and gave me my first pair of binoculars when I was about 10 years old, and I never put them down. Wow, not something I've seen in my life. Now I'm traveling the globe to explore the world of birds.
That's amazing. It's like a cloud.
And their relationship with us, those of us who don't have wings.
Oh, yes!
I'll show you what I adore about these crazy smart. Here, first look at the outside world. Dazzling.
It's fantabulous.
And super-powered feathered creatures.
This is a clip from the Extraordinary Birder episode called Birds of Puerto Rico, again hosted by our guest, Christian Cooper.
The best part of birding on an island is finding species that can't be found anywhere else. We birders call them endemics. This place is home to 17 endemic species of birds, and I'm hoping to spot a few of them to add to my life list. The Puerto Rican parrot is a special bird. With its bright green and blue feathers and red-striped brow, it's the pride of all Puerto Ricans. Way back, the island's Taíno Indians named it Iguaca, after the squawking sound it makes when it flies. Sadly, nature's dealt the iguaca a bit of a rough hand. And between hurricanes, hungry predators, and a lack of environmental protection, they were down to just 13 birds in the wild in the early 1970s. Now, there's a plan to bring them back.
A clip from Extraordinary Birder, National Geographic series. Christian Cooper just won an Emmy for this series. It's amazing. So tell us the countries that you went to for this series.
Well, that's the thing. Because it was COVID and because of budget, they kept us domestic for the season. So we went to Palm Springs, California, New York City, Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, Hawaii, oh, boo-hoo, boo-hoo, I had to go to Hawaii, and Alabama. And the Alabama episode was the most important to me because that was the collision not just of birding, but of family history and civil rights history. And you would be surprised how these things can inform each other. And we explored that a little bit in the episode. I had gone down to Alabama a year earlier at the invitation of Alabama Audubon, and the experience for me was so enlightening that I wanted to recreate it for the viewers. So the Alabama episode is
Tell us more about Alabama and how all these worlds intersect.
Sure. Well, for example, I walked across for the first time the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which is where Bloody Sunday happened. And so I'm walking across and thinking about what happened on this bridge. And meanwhile, there are cliff swallows that are nesting underneath it. And I realize, you know, these cliff swallows were probably here all those years ago, and they witnessed, they were there, they were part of that history to be there when all that happened. So there's that connection. Then there's other things like my father's family, and we're all Northerners for generations, but you go far enough back in the history of any African Americans and our roots are in the South. And my dad's father's side of the family came from Alabama, but I had never been. And I didn't want to go, because I'm like, my family left there for a reason. I had never been to the Deep South. But the chance to go in the tender arms of Alabama Audubon made it. I'm like, well, if there's ever going to be a chance to go, this is it. So I went. And it was fascinating to see what expectations were violated, what were affirmed. For example, walking around in Birmingham, and there are all these cafes with rainbow flags in the window. And I'm like, wait, what? But, you know, that actually makes sense, because, you know, you go across the country, and in the urban areas, they tend to be pretty progressive and actually very welcoming of queer people. But then you go outside, even here in New York, you know, you're here in the city, and it's very welcoming to queer people. But if you go to regions upstate, you know, there are parts where it's redder than red Iowa or something like that. So, you know, that was a revelation to me. But then other things, like the fact that, you know, my family had left Alabama and come to the North. Why? Because there was, you know, that was part of the Great Migration, when black people left the South for opportunity in the North, economic opportunity, jobs, and to escape oppression. That's exactly what birds do every year. That's why they migrate. They leave the South for the North, because there are resources in the North that they can exploit to raise their young and be more successful and pass on a better life to the next generation. That's why black people left the South. And we even use the same word, migration, for the birds, the Great Migration for black people. So things like that, you know, just all sort of collide and inform each other and change your view of things.
And then you know, for the, as you said earlier, for the National Geographic series, you weren't able to travel abroad because of COVID and so on. But you did, and you write about it in the book, you did actually go to several countries on your own, including Nepal, Tanzania. You said earlier that you'd also been to Belize. I mean, these are countries that are at the forefront of the climate crisis, which is, of course, also threatening all forms of nature, including birds. So if you could say a little about what you saw in these places, and this is obviously a limited number, I imagine you've been to many other places to bird, and the concerns you have about the climate crisis and the threat that it poses to bird life.
The best example I can give you is a trip I took in December down to Antarctica. I know, it was amazing. It's like visiting a different planet. But we got down there, and I was sort of, you know, a special guest on the boat, and so I wanted to, you know, be helpful to the other people on the ship and tell them, all right, well, we're going to make our landing at this particular spot, and I researched what kind of penguins we were going to see there. I said to everybody, all right, well, this is the penguin we're likely to see at this spot. And we get there, this is a colony of Adelie penguins. And we get there, and it's almost entirely Gen 2 penguins. And I'm like, ugh. I botched that completely. The penguin researcher on the boat said to me, no, you don't understand. I was here 2 years ago, and that colony was almost entirely Adelie penguins. Adelie penguins are true Antarctic penguins. They rely on ice for making their livelihood. Gen 2 penguins are what they call sub-Antarctic penguins, and the lack of ice is what lets them spread. So the fact that in 2 years, that colony had converted almost entirely from Adelie penguins, the Antarctic penguins, to Gen 2 penguins is a sign of just how quickly climate change is happening, particularly down there, because it's changing faster at the poles than any place else. So we were able to see in real time ourselves that our climate is changing way faster than most creatures can adapt. And, you know, there will be winners and losers. You know, Gen 2 penguins, at least for a while, are going to, you know, have an advantage. But what's scary is that most species can't adapt to change successfully that's that fast, including us.
Christian Cooper, author of Better Living Through Birding, Notes from a Black Man in the Natural World. He's just won an Emmy for his National Geographic series, Extraordinary Birder. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Spark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
You are listening.